Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is June 27th, 2020, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of this SGEM Extra is Presenting in a Northern Constellation. I had the pleasure of presenting at the Northern Constellation Faculty Development Conference 2020 back on May 8th. This was the 9th annual conference put on by the Northern School of Medicine, or NOSM. Dr. Sarah McIsaac was kind enough to invite me to present at the Northern Constellation Conference. She's an anesthesiologist intensivist at Health Science North, assistant professor and medical director of faculty development for NOSM. This presentation is available for you to watch on the SGEM YouTube channel, and all the slides will, of course, be available FOMED for you to download. I was asked to give a presentation about evidence-based medicine, critical appraisal, and relate it back to COVID-19. Certainly, there's been a lot of information coming out on the topic, and it can seem like, at times, you are drinking from a fire hose. The presentation was broken down into three parts: evidence-based medicine, critical appraisal, and the Peltzman effect, or risk compensation. Now, I should apologize because some of the audio breaks down at times. I did my best to clean it up, but there still are a few little glitches that I couldn't clean up. Anyways, here you go. I was a little bit embarrassed by Dr. McIsaac's very generous introduction of me. So I hope you enjoy this SGEM Extra.
Very, very privileged to be introducing you to our keynote speaker for our first ever virtual Northern Constellations. Dr. Ken Milne is a father, husband, and all-around amazing individual. He is chief of staff at South Huron Hospital in Exeter, Ontario. And like many of us here at NOSM, he works in a rural community. And if you know Ken, you know he is passionate about skepticism and critical thinking. He is creator of the very well-known website and podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. He's been doing medical research for well over 35 years and published on a variety of topics. And one of my most favorite sayings I've heard recently from Ken is that academics is not a postal code. And I think that's so fitting. He's a rural doc, just like us. And yet he's a leader in Canada in critical appraisal. I would also be remiss if I did not recognize Ken's amazing wife, Barb. You got it. That's Ken and Barbie. Barb is also passionate about rural medicine. I think she was incredibly influential to Ken saying yes to being our keynote and plenary speaker for Northern Constellation. I am so grateful to them both. I first was introduced to Ken's amazing work as a NOSM resident when I was traveling back and forth on Highway 7 between Sudbury and Ottawa. There's a 30-minute stretch whereby you don't get any cell phone reception and you don't get any radio. And so with my husband's encouragement, he told me to download some podcasts. At first, I downloaded some anesthesia podcasts, and I nearly crashed the car because I almost fell asleep at the wheel. They were so boring. And then he introduced me to The Skeptic's Guide of Emergency Medicine, and I had an opportunity to download Ken's podcast. And they were so exciting. I actually felt like Ken was in the car with me driving, and I could have a conversation with him. And I became passionate about how not only does he critically appraise, but how he's gifted at teaching, and how he's gifted at teaching critical appraisal and disseminating it virtually. So I am so privileged and honored to have Ken here as our virtual guest speaker to talk to us, not only about critical appraisal, but also about the Peltzman effect, which he recently introduced me to that new concept. So I hope you enjoy the next hour with Ken, and enjoy yourselves. Thanks to everybody for participating in our first virtual Northern Constellations. We hope to make it better, badder, and more exciting next year. And without no further ado, Ken, I'll send it over to you.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to know that this is the first time you've done this. So by definition, this will be the best virtual conference you've ever had, or the worst, depending if you're a glasses half full, glass empty kind of person. I should apologize to you. You do not want me in your head. I'm a good car mate, though. I'll go traveling with you, but you don't want me in your head. It's dangerous. And to give the true story about how I signed up to do the Northern Constellation Conference, like most things in life, it's complicated. My wife's friend's daughter got into the Northern School of Medicine, and she said, Ken, you should go to this conference. It'll be great. And we can visit her and say hi and be supportive of her first year in medical school. And I have two responses to my wife: yes, dear, or I'm sorry. And so, of course, I said, yes, dear, I'd be happy to do that. And so I'm very excited to be able to present some information about COVID-19 and introduce people to the Peltzman effect. I do need to start with my business slide, and that's the conflict of interest slide. And so I do need to make some disclosures. And the first disclosure is I am a huge nerd. And you already stole my thunder because I had in my talk that academics should not be defined by a postal code. What really matters is up here, not your postal code, not the bricks and mortar around you, but the academic is up top. I don't get any money. I'm not funded by Big Pharma. I'm also not funded by Big Farm either. I don't take any money from medical device companies. I do work for a couple of teaching agencies. I do medical malpractice cases, acting as an expert witness. And I do have a pediatric resuscitation device with my son that was the result of his grade 10 science fair project. Disclosures done. All right, let's get on to COVID-19. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but it can seem like we are dripping from a fire hose over the last 2 months. I mean, the emails, the new protocols, the changes in PPE, sometimes multiple times during the shift. It can be exhausting and overwhelming. I don't know how you guys are sleeping, but I'm rolling around going, oh, did I doff? Did I don? Did I doff? Did I don? It can be exhausting. So here's what we're going to talk about today. I had to come up with some objectives. So we're going to have three objectives. The first objective is I want to discuss evidence-based medicine because that is my approach to the literature and to my practice for the last 25 years. I also want to take you through a five-step, yes, my favorite number, a five-step critical appraisal process so you can understand how to critically appraise the literature for its validity. And then finally, the third part, what you're all waiting for, is I want to discuss the Peltzman effect. Very interesting. But we'll leave that till the end. Okay, let's get on with what is evidence-based medicine. Well, we need to go back to Dr. David Sackett, and he is the one who defined evidence-based medicine as the conscientious, explicit, judicious use of the current best evidence in making decisions about the care of individual patients. Now, you'll note I put in yellow, highlighted, shared decisions, because I like to make shared decisions, but that term really didn't exist when Dr. Sackett was doing this evidence-based medicine definition. So what does that really mean? So let's take a look at a Venn diagram. Here's a Venn diagram that represents the definition of evidence-based medicine. In the top right corner, you will see a physician, and you need to still use your clinical judgment when deciding how to practice. Most of us, and I experience this quite often when I go to teach, think evidence-based medicine is all around about the bottom circle, the literature. What does the RCT say? Is there a systematic review meta-analysis on this? What is the evidence? And while the evidence is great, I mean, it may not be great evidence, but it should guide our care. It shouldn't dictate our care. We still need to use this, our good clinical judgment. And then in the top left-hand corner, you'll see the people, the patients. Those individuals need to be asked what they value and what they prefer. And by taking those three pillars of evidence-based medicine, the literature which informs our care, our good clinical judgment, and then reaching out and engaging our patients because they are an expert at them, while we may be an expert at medicine, where those things combine and overlap, we have evidence-based medicine and great care. Now, there is levels of evidence. It's a hierarchy. I used to have a nice pyramid for this slide because it looks so crisp and clean and structured. It's usually not that simple. It's rough, it's irregular, and there's some real nuance to the levels of evidence-based medicine. But down at the bottom is things like case reports, expert opinion, anecdotes, and they can really be hypothesis generating. And as you move up this pyramid, you get to the mid-level, and that's randomized control trials. The highest level is actually a systematic review. There is one higher level, And that's a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled crossover trial with an N of one. Because we don't typically treat a population of patients. What we treat is an individual patient. And we want to know, is it going to work for that individual? But this next slide really captures the nuance of systematic reviews and meta-analysis. So I said that that was the pinnacle, the peak of the pyramid. You know, you have to look at the individual studies that go into the systematic review, and garbage in, garbage out. So if you have crappy, low quality evidence that's being mashed together in a meat grinder, it doesn't come out tasting very well. So I would take a really good, high quality randomized control trial with a really good patient-oriented outcome over some crappy systematic review that only included observational studies. So it is a bit of an artificial hierarchy. There are people that argue against evidence-based medicine, and it is not an answer for everything because there's limits to evidence-based medicine. Evidence-based medicine has some constraints. Now, there's a number of different constraints, but one of the key ones I want to talk about just briefly is the one about harm, because this one's brought up all the time. And this refers back to the parachute trial. This was a study published in the BMJ in their holiday edition 17 years ago. And the premise was that we didn't have good, well, they wanted to do a systematic review on whether or not wearing a parachute could prevent death and major trauma from jumping out of an airplane. And why they were asking that question is there were case reports of people falling out of an airplane in free fall without a parachute who survived. And there were people that used a parachute and got iatrogenic injuries. So we didn't have definitive data. So they wanted to search the world's literature and find out if we could answer that question about jumping out of an airplane. Is it better to have a parachute on or not? Since they couldn't find any studies, they suggested taking up all the EBM advocates, people like me, and randomizing them into one person would wear a parachute and the other person in a blinded fashion would wear a sham. It would be a backpack. They would fly up and then all jump out of the aircraft. And to make it more rigorous, they said, we should make this into a crossover trial. So if you survive the first jump, you would be randomized or you would be sent into the other group, go back up in the aircraft and jump again. And then we would have definitive evidence that wearing a parachute prevents major trauma and mortality when jumping out of an airplane. Well, obviously for ethical reasons, we can't do randomized control trials on things involving harm. I mean, who's going to sign up or which IRB or which ethics board is going to approve early or late antibiotics for sepsis, early or late antibiotics for meningitis? We can't put people in harm's way. There has to be equipoise, right? But Hayes et al. Came out in CMAJ that most practices that we do in medicine are not analogous to parachutes. We can do randomized control trials on those things. But the next slide is that they actually did do a randomized control trial looking at parachutes. And this was in December of 2018. Yes, they did an RCT on whether parachutes could prevent death or injuries. What they did was they recruited 92 passengers from an aircraft. They had to be 18 years of age or older. And 23 agreed to participate and be randomized. They would either get a parachute or a backpack. And the composite in outcome was death or major trauma. The results from the study was it did not, the parachute, the intervention did not reduce death or major injury. It was 0% in both groups. And don't get me started on p-values, but it was greater than 0.9. Now, this study really makes us focus in on the methodology and say, how could that be? How could there not be a difference when jumping out of an airplane? The reason is in the details. There was a difference between those who participated and those who didn't participate in the study. People who agreed to participate jumped at an average height of 0.6 meters, going 0 kilometers an hour while the plane was on the ground. while the non-participants were traveling at 9,000 meters or 9 kilometers and traveling at 800 kilometers an hour. So you've got to look at the details. So of course, we can't do evidence-based medicine and things involving harm, and there are some other limits. But what are the other options? Let's go through 5 other options that you could do instead of evidence-based medicine. The first one is eminence-based medicine. Oh yes, you know that senior colleague. Glasses, thinning hair, little gray going on. Yeah, you know what? They've been making the same mistakes with increasing confidence over an impressive number of years. We do not want to have eminence-based medicine. There's so many cognitive biases within us that could make us make the wrong decisions. We need higher levels of evidence, not eminence-based medicine. Okay, how about vehemence-based medicine? This is where you substitute quality research for a volume of research and just paper over someone with study after study after study that is really low quality. We want high quality evidence with clinically important outcomes for the patients. The next one you may have seen if you attended some swanky conference, and that's eloquence-based medicine. Clearly, I don't practice it. Look at, I'm wearing a golf shirt. It is Lululemon, but I'm wearing a golf shirt. But this is eloquence-based medicine. And this is the presenter with the year-round, you know, suntan, silk tie, Armani suit. Oh, and that tongue. That smooth voice, convincing you with eloquence. And that's a powerful substitute for evidence, but that's not what we should do. Now, a fourth way to practice medicine would be nervous-based medicine. And this is the fear of litigation. And it's a powerful stimulus to over-testing and over-treating. Now, this may be a greater factor in the US, while here in Canada, we may be more worried about being shamed by our colleagues at M&M rounds or being reported to the college. But in an atmosphere of litigation and shame phobia, the only bad test is the test you didn't order under nervous-based medicine. And then the fifth option would be confidence-based medicine, but this is pretty much restricted just to surgeons. But anyways, evidence-based medicine. Here's a quote from Winston Churchill, and this is how I feel about evidence-based medicine. It is the worst form of medicine, except all the others that have been tried. Do we really want to go back to non-randomized, non-blinded trials, start using bloodletting to treat sepsis, listen to people who are our senior colleagues who say, well, that's how we've always done it here? No, patients deserve the best care based on the best evidence. So that is my section on evidence-based medicine. The next slide is just a pause slide to entertain any questions that have come in about evidence-based medicine. And I'm happy to answer any chat questions that you've received, Dr. McIsaac.
So I haven't received any questions yet, but I'm happy to get started though. So I think I found it really interesting. You brought in the aspect of the parachute trial. That was 17 years ago, and I that number just resonated with me because SARS was 17 years ago in Toronto and all the publications came out. What do we do when there's no evidence? And I think that's one of the things I've been really struggling with as a clinician during this pandemic, is that there's just been no great evidence since for 17 years on how do we manage these coronaviruses, how do we keep our staff safe. I can't find any randomized control trial that looks at PPE for healthcare workers. So what do you do? What would be your advice?
You know, one of the criticisms of evidence-based medicine is that you'll be paralyzed by action because there's no randomized control trial. But remember, in that hierarchy, that pyramid, randomized control trial was mid-level. Just because we don't have high-quality evidence to inform our care and guide our care doesn't mean we don't have any evidence. And often in medicine, there are lots of examples in medicine where we don't have good evidence. And we need to rely on our clinical experience, things like pathophysiology. It makes sense. There's some reason to expect that from a physiologic standpoint. And so we move forward, because I make decisions all the time in the emergency department with lack of information, high quality information. and you do your best with the information that's available. So you don't become cynical and you don't become nihilistic. And I know that it's easy to throw your arms up and go, well, if there's no randomized control trial, I can't do anything. Yes, you can. You still have a patient and you still need to act in their best interest. And so when there isn't great evidence guiding your care, I think one of the best things to do is enter shared decision making. The evidence is weak. That means maybe the clinical experience circle of the Venn diagram enlarges, and maybe the patient's values and preferences enlarges as well, and say, you know, be honest and transparent. We don't have good evidence to know which way is the right way. What would you like to do? What do you value? What would be your preference? And Dr. McIsaac, one other thing, though, the 7 years, I have to say it, that's from that. How long does it take for high quality, clinically relevant information to reach the patient's bedside? And the answer is 17 years, not for 100%, but for 14%. So this is no surprise that since SARS 2017 or 17 years later, we really haven't got a handle on this. This is not my surprised face.
Okay. Well, we have a question from Dr. Verma, who's our dean. What are your views on prescience-based medicine, where there is no evidence and no one to ask because the clinical problem is new and you rely on your gut?
Well, I mean, you can say I guess it depends on your definition of precedence and what you mean by your gut. I assume that is coming down to clinical gestalt. And it often comes down to, what's my clinical gestalt? I have this patient, they're experiencing this new disease, and I have this amount of information, and I'm just going to act in their best interest. And I always say that I have an NNT of one, a number needed to treat of one, which means I'm going to try to help every patient I have, and I'm going to do it with kindness. And so if you don't have much evidence, just be honest with patients. I think the biggest pitfall is coming in with a whole bunch of swagger and confidence and say, I know what's right, paternalistic, authoritative medicine. When it's really, we're standing on pillars of salt and sand most of the time.
That's very true. We have one more question here, is how do we integrate local data, personalized data into the application of RCTs? And so they're asking, do you see any changes to what we should look at high quality evidence, other sources than the literature? And I think they're referring to the gray literature.
The gray literature? You mean like this? The gray literature is a term referred to as unpublished data, and there is unpublished data out there. And so if you look for a systematic review, a good one will involve a medical librarian who will search the gray literature and help you in that regard. But I want to pull out one other comment or something that I thought was in that question, and that was our local experience. And a lot of research is done at urban centers, not academic centers. You know where the academics happen. Right? At urban centers. And then it's extrapolated out to a rural center. And so a lot of my career has been trying to publish rural data. And so we don't have to say, well, does this have any external validity? So if there are any young researchers, middle-aged researchers, older researchers, people with a certain level of maturity researchers, that's how I address patients that are older based on your maturity. If you're interested, all you have to do, and this is how I did a bunch of my studies, was I would take an urban design and say, well, listen, they did this study. It got ethics approval. It must be okay. One of them was on pain control. One of them was on door to needle time for thrombolysis. I called that one barn door to needle time. And just replicated the study with the same methodology that had been all approved. So that legwork had been done and said, but does it apply to my rural clinical setting? And so we can have, you know, rural patients informing our rural care. And I think that's really important.
I think so, too.
All right, so here we go. Five steps to critical appraisal. There's the PICO, the search for the literature. That's the pyramid I used to use. Look at how great it is. It's a rainbow color. It's got, you know, really sharp edges. And then the fourth step is to do a quality checklist, probing the literature for its validity. And then that reflective period where you go, how does that fit in with the existing literature? And can I apply that to my patient population? So let's dive into that just a little bit deeper. The first step is a PICO. And so that's the population, the intervention, the comparator, or the outcome. And so let's start with the population of the PICO, the P. And we can use an example of, let's say, Bell palsy. So let's say you have a 72-year-old man. He's highlighted there in yellow, and he has what you think to be a Bell palsy. So the specific question you may have is, what is the best treatment for a 72-year-old man with Bell palsy, considering all the other medications they may or may not be on and their comorbidities? You need to search for a paper that has that population. If it only includes people under the age of 21 and women, it may not have much validity for your search. The next thing you want to do is look for the intervention. If you're looking for an intervention that treats Bell palsy, look for the specific intervention. Are you interested in steroids? Are you interested in antivirals? Are you interested in a combination of those things or some other treatment? So what was the intervention? The next thing to do in that first step of the PICO is to look for, what was the control group or the comparison group? Was it a placebo-controlled trial? Did they have some kind of sham? Was there no control or no comparison? Was it compared to a straw man? I mean, we see this often in pain studies where they will come out with a new biologic agent, some kind of analgesic, some kind of thing to help with an acute pain issue, and then they'll compare it to very low dose or a non-standard dose of acetaminophen or ibuprofen. And that's a straw man comparison. And then you've got to look at the outcomes. Oh, I love this slide because it talks about the do's, lose, moos, and poos, right? You want a patient-oriented outcome, and that's highlighted as a poo, right? You want a patient-oriented outcome. And in the case of Bell's palsy, it may be, I want a good cosmetic appearance. I'm concerned about function, speech. I'm concerned about my vision with my eyelid closing, those types of things. A moo, and I'm really trying to coin this term, a monitored-oriented outcome, maybe you have an EMG hooked up to the face and you're testing, you know, the strength of the motor function. And that would be a moo, a lab-oriented outcome, like measuring viral load or something, or a disease-oriented outcome. So step two of this five-step process is you need to search for the best evidence, right? You don't want to just say, oh, there's an expert opinion at the bottom there, somebody writing an opinion piece, when there already is a RCT on that or a systematic review meta-analysis. So you need to have a good search strategy. Now, you can use Dr. Google. In the age of social media, you can use Facebook, Instagram, TikTok now. But I searched for Bell palsy, and the Google search got almost, well, 760,000 hits. Google Scholar can refine it down to about 30,000 hits. People obviously are familiar who are listening to this of PubMed, but even PubMed got close to 1,500 hits when searching for Bell palsy treatment. Now, I want to give some people some other great things, search strategies, and that's on the right-hand side of the slide. And so there's something called TRIP database. That's turning research into practice. TRIP database. Love it. It does secondary level evidence, in other words, RCTs and above, and you can search it and you can refine your search, and it's a really great search engine for looking for evidence. The Cochrane database of systematic reviews, of course, I'm a big Cochrane fan. They've done fabulous work over the past. And then finally, clinicaltrials.gov. You can go to this website, and researchers are now supposed to register their trial and say what they plan to do, what their methodology will be, what's their primary and secondary outcomes, and then you can look at the published results and see if they are. So you can go to clinicaltrials.gov as another search engine. The next is the pyramid, and there is, you want to find the least biased, the highest form of evidence. So I've got the most biased in that guy in the right-hand lower quadrant there. He's got a lab coat on, a stethoscope. He's smiling nicely. Yeah, that's the expert opinion, background information. You should demand better evidence. And so as you go up that pyramid, and then I, as an example, I've got the Cochrane reviews at the top of quality of evidence. And then the next step is to do a quality checklist to appraise the literature. And there are various checklists available online. I've referenced one there. That's for the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine.net. That's in Oxford. And they do, in their website, you can search for their checklist. And they've got one for randomized control trials, for observational studies, systematic reviews, clinical decision instruments for diagnostics and therapeutics. Usually they have somewhere between, I don't know, 6 and 11 questions that you go through and you say yes, no, or maybe when you're appraising quality indicators. And you can get really good at it. And how you get really good and fast is first you get good, then you get fast. But it's practice, practice, practice. And so you just pull out a checklist and say, are these the patients of interest? Did they adequately randomize these patients? Did they blind the randomization? All of those types of things. Quality checklists. And then the last step, the fifth step, is this practice changing? You need to look back and reflect upon the evidence that you've critically appraised, considering the limitations and external validity, and then decide, is the number needed to treat for benefit compared to the number needed to treat for harm convincing? Does it make a difference? Is it important? Will it change your practice? And of course, the burden of proof is on those making the claim. And so that is their burden. And that's the next slide. The burden of proof is on those that make the claim. And the time to accept a claim is when sufficient evidence has been provided. There are very few times where we have one paper that's enough to change practice, that's so good, that's so robust, that covers what we need to know. But when you do get enough accumulation of evidence, that's the time to accept the claim, when you have sufficient evidence. Until you have sufficient evidence, the burden has not been met, and we should accept the null hypothesis of no superiority. Now, we do all have cognitive biases. I'd like to identify mine. I mean, I have cognitive biases. I've been wrong in the past. I've been wrong maybe during this talk. I've got an audience of individuals who may or may not have more expertise in these areas than I have. I can acknowledge that, and I probably will be wrong in the future too. So we need to, you know, the first step to managing cognitive biases is recognizing that you have them and knowing what they are. And I want to be clear, when I say bias, it's not some random noise in the background of the data. Bias is something that systematically moves us away from the truth. So I like to use this sailing metaphor, showing that the bias is the wind and it's blowing the sailboat off course in a systematic way, whereas the truth lies straight ahead. And yet the wind is that bias pushing us away. And the waves that are just undulating there is the random noise of data. So at the end of the day, when you're doing critical appraisals, I want to give you the same message that I got from my EBM mentor. And that's Dr. Andrew Worster. And he taught me that when it comes to clinical questions, the EBM answer is, it all depends. And he drilled this into my head. And I learned that when I'm approaching a clinical problem, one of the best things I can say is, it all depends. You may need more information. And he started the Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine project at McMaster University, I think about 15 years ago. And was kind enough to bring me under his wing and teach me, and certainly has made me a much better clinician. That is a five-step approach to critical appraisal.
I really love that sailboat analogy. That's awesome. Constantly, constantly have biases that are blowing us off course from the truth and the reality of what's underneath the research. So I do have a question from one of our faculty, and they're asking, how do you resolve conflict when your colleagues are not up to date with the evidence or aren't interested in the evidence you think may change management of a patient? So it's more a conflict resolution. What would be your advice to that faculty member?
That is a problem that can be experienced on a regular basis. I approach it like I approach most things, with kindness. And your colleagues, I mean, start with common ground. They want their patients to get the best care. So if there's a conflict between what the evidence says and you're concerned that that individual is not practicing the best evidence, which could result in a better patient-oriented outcome, go back to the patient. It starts with patient care and it ends with patient care. And so I am sure, like, none of us got into medical school in an interview and said, you know what, I want to be a jerk. I want to go around on rounds and piss people off. I want to have conflict with my colleagues. No, they said they were there because why? Why, Dr. McIsaac? Why did you say you wanted to be a doctor? Because you want to help people.
Help people.
want to help people. And it's true. And I know I'm being melodramatic, but it's true. And so if you can go back to that core fundamental part of being a clinician, of wanting to help suffering and ameliorate pain and be there as a resource and putting the patient at the center of our care, I find that that works. And the other thing is, I don't try to do it all at once. I do it with nudges, you know, and you can do various nudges. You can leave a research paper sitting on their desk. You can send them a casual email. You can have a hallway conversation that said, hey, I saw that you use magnesium in that crashing asthmatic. I was wondering, where did you get the information for that? I'd like to know more about that. You seem to have some extra information. Do you mind talking to me about it? Can we grab a coffee? Right? And so it has to be non-threatening, and sometimes you have to ease into it. But, you know, the in-your-face approach, yeah, I've been unsuccessful with that. It's like, you ignorant clinician, I can't believe you're still doing, you know, X, Y, and Z. So,
yeah, I agree. I think you're very right. We focus back, bring the patient back, center and forward, so that we all have. It's very hard to argue that that's not a shared common ground. And so the patient center forward, and then we can discuss evidence. I have one more question out here. Someone was wondering if people find it possible to do that sort of research to answer a clinical question in a time frame that actually allows it to be implemented for the patient in front of you. And I think we all face that challenge. Is I have a great question. I want to know the answer so I can help my patient. But am I going to be able to do that now? And I always felt like that as a resident. I had great questions I wanted to answer. I'm like, I'm never going to get this study done before residency and probably not my fellowship. And I'll probably be having a retirement party by the time it's done.
You mean getting the study done or actually accessing in a medical informatics to answer the question in front of you? Because obviously you're not going to run a clinical trial when you're working in the clinic that day or in the emergency department or the operating room, right?
I think they're asking, how do we do this in a time frame? Ask a clinical question in a time frame that actually allows you to implement that immediately in front of that patient in front of you.
So again, it's the practice of medicine, and it doesn't happen all at once, and we learn iteratively. And so to think that you're a fully completed physician by the time you graduate from medical school or the time you graduate from residency, or in my case, after 25 years of clinical practice, I learn every day, and I learn from patients, I learn from my colleagues, I learn from the nurses, the people that I have working on my great team. I learn every day, and you develop really good search strategies. So going to clinicaltrials.gov is a great way to do it, but also just keep a note of that because you don't need to solve every problem at that time, right? And if it is a question, it's probably not life-threatening. Very few things have a number needed to treat of one for mortality, right? So it's okay. You can look into it later. You don't have to do it in real time. And as you get better and better and better, you'll find resources that you trust, and you'll be able to implement those and change your practice and incorporate. And you may find, I mean, for me, it was originally the medicine that made it interesting. Ooh, look, they have this disease, that disease, this disease, that disease. And then it became the patients. And now it's the patient that has that condition that's really engaging me. And there's some clinical questions that come up along the way.
I love kind of how you always bring it back center forward to the patient. There's just a comment I'll share with you that someone also really loved your sailboat analogy and saying that it can be applied right at the bedside, not just when thinking about evidence. Our biases can directly affect our assessment of a patient and steer us away from the truth. And so I really thank you for that teaching tip. I'm going to certainly apply that. And it looks like other faculty really enjoyed that analogy as well. So thank you for that. So we're going to move on. I think we saved the best for last. I'm going to put myself on mute and just sit back and listen.
I've taught about evidence-based medicine for well over a decade and critical appraisal and those types of things. But this Pelsman effect really came into focus COVID-19. And so I'm going to frame it around COVID-19. Those not familiar with the Pelsman effect, it was named after Sam Pelsman, and he was a professor at the University of Chicago in the 1970s. And he wrote this classic paper about seatbelt regulations for cars. Now, there's a classic 1970s car, those old enough to remember rolling around in those. I don't know if anybody remembers being in the back of a station wagon rolling around. There was no seatbelts. There was no child car seats. There were no booster seats. It was just rolling around. Actually, in my career, I've noticed the number of blunt traumas because of safety interventions in cars has been phenomenal. Anyways, he wrote this classic paper. See, the lab data, you know, technical studies implied that annual highway deaths would be 20% greater without legislation mandating seatbelts in all cars. He argued against it. Professor Peltzman said that the benefits would be offset by more pedestrian deaths and more non-fatal accidents because of what he quoted as driving intensity. In other words, people would drive less safe. They drive faster and more recklessly with the security of a safety belt on. They put their lap belt on and go, oh yes, I can go Mach 5 with my hair on fire. Now, ultimately, Dr. Peltzman's hypothesis about seatbelts was shown to be wrong. And I think I really need to emphasize this. Please buckle up. Wearing seatbelts does have a net benefit. But he introduced a concept of risk compensation when people adjust their behavior in response to a perceived level of threat. And so it's been named after him, the Peltzman effect. And there are examples where an intervention did have a positive outcome. Seatbelts is an example. Bike helmets is an example. So this went against what his hypothesis was, but it was named after him. A little bit of irony. But there are other examples where introducing safety things can have a negative outcome, or they can be mitigated, and so the outcome is neutral, where you think it should have a positive outcome, it works in the lab, it's a no-brainer, it makes sense, and when it actually goes into the wild, into practice, people are sometimes hard to predict, and they can do some pretty unique things, and how they will implement those things. So I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. And the first one is anti-lock brakes. Now, anti-lock brakes is a safety technology that allows cars, while braking, to steer. And so obviously, it's a no-brainer. If you can steer while braking, you can do crash avoidance. However, there are a number of studies that show if a vehicle has ABS, the operator drives faster, follows closer, and brakes later. In other words, more risk. And there was a study done in Munich, Germany, and it was a randomized trial, sort of. They had half their taxi cabs equipped with ABS brakes, and the other half were not equipped with ABS brakes. Now, this safety innovation had demonstrated improvement in vehicle handling in the lab, but it failed to reduce crashes and accidents when it was done in practice. The interpretation. The drivers knew whether they were driving a cab with anti-lock brakes or without ABS-equipped cabs. And the interpretation was, the reason we didn't see the benefit from the technology was that it was offset, the safety was offset by the risky behavior of the cab drivers. And there's lots of examples in car safety area. That's where a lot of it's done. But you also see stuff in skydiving, bring it back to the parachute trial. There was a suggestion that if you improve the equipment and improve the stuff that people had for skydiving, the injury and fatality rate would go down, when in fact it didn't. It stayed about the same. And again, people offset that risk and came to a new homeostasis because of it. Helmets for skiing, helmets for biking. Again, the gains you would expect to see were offset ultimately and shown to have no net improvement. A new risk homeostasis was achieved and a new balance was found, and it didn't have the positive impact people expected. Now, I'll bring this back to a little bit of medicine, and I'll talk about condoms here. It was widely felt in the early 2000s that condoms could help prevent the spread of the HIV epidemic, another epidemic that was going on at the time, as opposed to this new COVID-19. And like most things, it was more complicated. And Dr. Shelton published a piece called The 10 Myths and One Truths about Generalized HIV Epidemics. And this was in The Lancet in 2006. Condom use, especially by sex workers, is crucial for the containment of concentrated epidemics. So in the right clinical setting, it makes sense. However, when you do make a widespread recommendation about condom use, it can have limited impact in an epidemic. And certain people dislike using them, especially if they're in a regular relationship. The protection isn't perfect, and it's often not used appropriately. And people change their behavior and engage in riskier sex, either with a condom or with the thought of, oh, I'll have a condom, so it's okay. And so while the condoms were thought to really contain the HIV epidemic, it really didn't contain the HIV epidemic, as people changed behavior and there was this risk compensation and a new homeostasis was achieved because behavior of individuals changed. So now I want to focus in on, how about this Peltzman effect in healthcare? And Prasad and Jenna published this in 2014 in the Healthcare Administration Journal, and wrote about the unintended behavioral consequences of patients and physicians to healthcare interventions. And while they seemed logical and foolproof, they failed to demonstrate real-life benefits. And so I'm going to use one of my favorite examples. This would be the point where I would look out into the crowd and says, who here loves their electronic health record? Who gets warm, fuzzy feelings every time they get to sit down in front of their computer and try to log in and go, oh, it says I have to change my password. And it has to have a capital, and it has to have a symbol, and it has to have a number. And you're just like, ugh. Well, EHRs do reduce errors. They reduce prescription errors. So if we put this into practice, the hope was that electronic health records would improve care. However, when they actually looked at this, it does decrease some errors, but it increases other errors. And in the emergency department, it's shown to decrease throughput in the emergency department, increase wait time, increase length of stays. Basically, almost all the metrics you can measure in the emergency department get worse with EHRs. In addition, EHRs are cited as the number one reason of burnout in physicians. And that's why I like this picture of the physician sort of closing the laptop and just going, ah. And we do have data that shows burnout is associated with poor patient outcome. So I don't think the people that said, hey, we've got this electronic health record, it'll streamline, it'll make capture data, it'll be great. I don't think they intended it to burn out physicians and ultimately result in poor patient care. You can also look at one other example within medicine, and that's on the same slide, and that's about metrics. And so once they started getting electronic health records and started capturing metrics, one example is they made it that you would publicly report PCI outcomes in patients with acute myocardial infarctions. And you thought, okay, well, that should be a good thing. You know, publish your results, show what your complications are, show what your outcomes are. But it led to the unanticipated consequence of some providers basically gaming the system. They declined to do PCI on high-risk patients because it'll make my metrics worse. It'll throw my stats off. And so those patients, perhaps with the greatest need because they were highest-risk patients, were not getting access to the care because of a Peltzman effect. All right, let's bring it into COVID-19 focus here. And when it comes to COVID-19, we've basically been throwing the kitchen sink at this, right? Researchers and clinicians have tried various medications, azithromycin, steroids, famantadine, malaria drugs, remdesivir is a new one, vitamin C, zinc, all of this stuff. Just the kitchen sink has been thrown at it. But from a public health measure, we've also tried various things that we seem to think are no-brainers. But I'm going to ask you to bring your brain back into this and think about the possible Peltzman effect and how we could mitigate that during COVID-19. First one I want to talk about is the mask for all mantra. We have very weak and limited information that masks for all worn in public will prevent transmission of clinically important COVID-19 in people that are physically distancing themselves. I mean, specifically cloth masks, that's what we're talking about, in asymptomatic people. Now, I know that there's data about asymptomatic transmission, pretty robust, actually, information now, but most of that is from family members in close contact sheltering together. What's the external validity of sheltering together with close family members to public places with people observing physical distancing? Cloth masks? Well, that's a source control. Well, if you're sick, what are you doing out in public if you're symptomatic? Can people wear it properly? I can't even see other healthcare workers wear it properly. I did see a video last week of a woman who walked into a store and she was wearing a mask, but she cut a hole through it. And the person asked, so why'd you cut a hole in your mask? And she goes, well, because it makes it easier to breathe. So we don't know how people will implement it. And will it make you touch your face more and increase hand transmission? Will people see healthcare workers wearing surgical masks and N95 masks and go, well, this cloth mask can't be as good as that, so I must buy up all of those so our frontline staff doesn't have proper PPE? Will it change your behavior by putting on a mask? Are you more likely to go out, not observe physical distancing, go out more often? I'm not saying, I'm not making a claim that masks don't work in COVID-19. What I am saying is we would be wise to consider the possibility of a Peltzman effect. Now, there is a counterpoint, and so in any good argument, you should always know what people who hold different positions think, and that's the next slide about the precautionary principle. And if you'd like to read more about the precautionary principle, this was done by Dr. Greenlaw. She is well known in the world of evidence-based medicine and described the precautionary principle. And while I think it's very good to consider the precautionary principle, very reasonable, I think it's also reasonable the Peltzman effect. And here is a slide that shows there are unanticipated consequences. There was a viral video that showed a man being dragged off by multiple police officers in the United States because they made it mandatory to wear a mask. And there's been several news reports like this about a mandatory mask policy. This is just one example. And I do recognize that it's a case report or an anecdote if you want, but those are hypothesis generating. And since we don't have good evidence that masks, cloth masks, worn by asymptomatic people in public who are physically distancing themselves will prevent individuals from getting clinical disease, and in this case, COVID-19. And without solid evidence convincing us of the benefit, and there certainly is a suggestion, a hypothesis of unanticipated consequences based on the Peltzman effect, anyone who says that they know the net impact of a mask for all policy, I would suggest they don't know. And my position on masks in public is, if you want to wear a mask in public, fine. I'm not going to rip it off your face. But if you don't want to wear a mask in public and you're asymptomatic and you're physically distancing, I'm not going to shame you or, worse, assault you physically for not wearing a mask. So that's the section on masks and COVID-19. Here's a section about stay home. This is another risk compensation concern to the homeostasis. It's great that we've done such a fabulous job of flattening the curve and encouraging everyone to stay home. However, I've been more and more concerned that we may have done too good of a job and also not advised people that, you know what, if you're concerned, please come to the emergency department because I'm an emergency physician and we're open 24/7, 365 for anyone at any time for anything. And we should have gotten the message out that it's safe. But volumes in the emergency departments across the country are down about 50%. This is because people have been very socially responsible, great. And they're also anxious about coming into the ED, fear of catching the Rona. We're seeing less MIs, less strokes, and less other acute conditions. And those that do come in are usually coming in late. So we'll see completed MIs, CVAs from 3 days ago, or ruptured appendixes. And as we say in the country, the horse is out of the barn by then. There's also been an increase in death at home. So flattening the curve is good for our healthcare system. I don't want to encourage people not to do that in managing the COVID-19 surge of patients. But we're just not seeing that. And the question is, what cost did it come at? And did we do too well? And we can't just consider COVID-19 morbidity and mortality. But I would suggest we need to consider all morbidity and mortality. And then the one final thing on this stay-at-home thing is another unintended consequences of this strong message, and that is the potential increase in domestic violence. We're all under more stress. I'm not sleeping as well as I'd like to. I'm not getting much exercise. We're supposed to be physically distancing and not socially distancing, but it's been hard, and it's been hard to handle. And I know other people out there are suffering. But just think about all those other people that don't have as good a coping skill as maybe you and I. Those in abusive relationships forced to stay at home, to find an increase in inter-partner violence. And Dr. Carrie Samsel in Ottawa is an expert in this area and has expressed concern in some news reports about it. And child abuse is also a concern. Schools have been closed and children are sheltering at home with their caregivers. But it's teachers that are often the ones to recognize signs and symptoms of child abuse. And I had not thought about this as a possible downstream unintended consequences of the stay at home, shelter at home, close schools, until my good friend, Dr. Anthony Crocco, who's in charge of McMaster Pediatric Emergency Department, he said that he's worried that the incidence of abuse will go up of children because of increased stress at home, but also the reporting will go down because people are staying at home. Again, a possible and sad Peltzman effect. All right, so to conclude with this section, I just want to quote Richard Feynman, who famously said, it's okay to say, I don't know. And will these social measures of COVID-19, of risk compensation, have a net positive, a net negative, or no effect? I don't know. But the strength of a recommendation should be proportional to the evidence. Any intervention has potential benefit and potential harm. And it's a cognitive bias that we all share, that we overestimate the potential benefit of an intervention and underestimate the potential harm of an intervention. And anyone who says that they know what the net impact of these social policies is expressing hubris, in my opinion. I've done research for over 35 years. I've practiced clinically for 25 years, and it's taught me a big dose of humility. I've been wrong in the past. Also working in the emergency department, I'm used to thin slicing and knowing that most of the time I'm standing on evidence that is pillars of salt and sand. And it's led me to grow comfortable with saying, I don't know. There's a great article by Jeannie Lenser and Sharon Brownlee. And this is Pandemic Science Out of Control. And it's the next slide. And it's just encouraging us to remember history. And I love the first paragraph of this article. So if you, it's free open access, click on it and just read the first paragraph, because it describes the fall of 1918 in the midst of the world's worst pandemic in modern history. Sound familiar? From 100 years ago. And they've got the Surgeon General of the US, and he's quoted as saying, you know, doctors are using anti-malarial drugs like quinine and digitalis, even though there was no evidence for those drugs. And they're using folk remedies like cinnamon and goose grease and salt stuffed up the nose, because doctors are desperate and willing to try just about anything. Paragraph goes on to say they eventually abandoned these treatments of quinine, digitalis, for the treatment of the Spanish flu when studies showed that they were not only ineffective, but cause serious and sometimes deadly side effects. And we are seeing history repeat itself with things like hydroxychloroquine being advocated without good evidence to inform our care. The final slide is just a reminder to reason. I've been quoted and said quite publicly that the New England Journal of Medicine is not my favorite journal. It's a very Canadian way of saying it. It's not my favorite journal, but they need to get a shout out when they publish really good articles like this. Again, the authors have a great paragraph saying that we're living through unprecedented times of biopsychosocial crisis. And physicians must be the voice of reason. I would say not just physicians, but clinicians, and lead by example. We must reason critically and reflect on our biases that may influence our thinking process. We need to critically appraise the literature. So I hope I've given you some tools on how to do that in this tsunami of COVID-19 information that you can appraise the literature in deciding how to treat patients and use anecdotes, observations to generate hypotheses for trials that we can conduct if clinical equipoise exists. We must act swiftly. This is a global pandemic. I agree with the authors, but we also must act careful with caution and reason. Our patients deserve the best care based on the best evidence. And so the last slide is about entertaining questions, but I just want to say that the global pandemic, we can feel its healthcare workers and essential services, that the weight of the world is on our shoulders. And I just want to look people in the eye through this virtual thing and say, it's okay not to be okay. You don't have to be a superhero. Asking for help can be a sign of strength and insight and not a sign of weakness. Thank you.
Wow, Ken, thank you so much. I think you and I could talk about the Peltzman effect for hours. I loved it. It's so fascinating. I really like also just how you brought in how it might be affecting our at-risk population and the unintended consequences to our at-risk population. And we certainly have a really good understanding here of that in Northern Ontario. We have a lot of at-risk populations in Northern Ontario. And I worry, I'm concerned that there's going to be a Peltzman effect.
If we end up harming more people while trying to help other people, I don't consider that a win.
I'm on the same page as you. I think, unfortunately, we've run a little bit late for time right now, so we won't have any questions right now. I would like to extend my sincere gratitude to you, Ken. This has been so much fun. We've smashed records with regards to our attendance, so thank you to all the faculty who have participated. I'm getting comments of applause, so I wish we had an applause button, but I'll do a round of applause. That was fabulous.
Thank you again to Dr. Sarah McIsaac and the Northern School of Medicine for inviting me to present at the Northern Constellation Annual Conference. The SGEM will be back next episode doing a structured critical appraisal of a recent publication, trying to cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year using the power of social media. Ultimately, we want patients to get the best care based on the best evidence. And remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.